Okay, so Book of Maccabees.
So,
the Book of Maccabees, I give you the translation. It was originally written in Hebrew, almost definitely. We don't have a Hebrew version anymore. We have lost it many hundreds, if not thousands of years ago. We have it in Greek. We have it in Greek. It was probably originally written in Hebrew. We don't have that version. It has been lost to... What? I mean, I can't prove it to you because we don't have the original. But almost definitely it was written in Hebrew. Almost definitely. I mean, it was almost definitely written. I can't promise you. Fighting
a war, it's a great thing.
Meaning?
Yeah, well,
the version that we have, it's not like we only... the reason we have it in Greek is we have it in the Septuagint, where everything is just a translation from Greek, from Hebrew. Right? There's no reason to believe this is any different. That's what we have. Okay. Okay, guys. But it is not part of Tanakh. Now, there really are... Guys.
This is not
important. Now, there are multiple books of Maccabees. There's Maccabees 1, Maccabees 2. There are multiple Maccabees, right? We're looking really at Maccabees 1 here.
There's like 8.
Yes, there's more than 2. There's many Maccabees. Maccabees is not part of our Tanakh. It is part of the Catholic canon.
Only the first two.
What?
Only the first two.
Only the first two, yes. Only the first two Maccabees are part of the Catholic canon. Why is it not in Tanakh? So, it is true. Chazal speak very viciously about people who read the Sifrei Chitzonim, which may refer to the Apocrypha, it may not. It is a machloket, it may refer to philosophy, it may refer, according to the Rif, to any, well,
there's a lot of
it's not clear this is actually the Rif. There's a lot of girsa issues in the proper and the more better manuscripts of the Rif that actually doesn't appear, but fine. But in something that is attributed to the Rif, Sifrei Chitzonim may be learning any interpretation of Tanakh that was not offered by Chazal, but...
it could also be just things which are useless.
So there's all types of things that it could be. There's all types of things that it could be. Now, but Maccabees is interesting because, so very quickly, Aaron asked me to talk about this, but obviously we have to enjoy Maccabees. Right. How did books become part of Tanakh? So we don't know exactly. We know Anshei Knesset HaGdola went through a canonization process. And we know, based on what we have in the Gemara, that they assessed the books. And if there were theological problems or halachic problems, they either didn't accept the book or spent the time figuring out how there were not, in fact, contradictions with the rest of the canon of Tanakh and allowed it in. But basically, there were certain halachic and theological criteria by which the Anshei Knesset HaGdola decided whether books made into Tanakh. And you know this from their discussions of should Kohelet be part of Tanakh, should Yechezkel be part of Tanakh, etc., why Ben Sira is not part of Tanakh, and things like that, yeah.
You said they would look at a book, Kohelet, I know those were examples, and then they would compare it to whether it was halachically and philosophically consistent with Tanakh, but there wasn't no Tanakh, so what
were
they comparing?
The books that were already canonized, or their assumptions about what Jewish theology was, right, meaning we don't know their exact process, but they're clearly, look, there was already, right, meaning this didn't happen at once, right, Chumash was obviously part of it, the early books of Nevi'im and Rishonim were already part of it, right, the question of what exactly gets in, right? It was a combination of what they assumed Jewish theology should be, what halacha was, what the books that were already canonized.
When?
So this happened over a course of years. This didn't happen right away. Hundreds of years. Hundreds, not hundred, right? Meaning the books became canonized. Some of them became canonized early, but as the Gemara already records, there were machlokot about Kohelet. There were machlokot about Esther. These books are written.
Was this early Second Temple period?
This is presumably when it's happening. Well, yeah, up to basically early Temple, right? Second Temple period. And they're going through books, and some make it in, and some don't make it in. We don't know much more than that. That's the description we have in Chazal. That's basically what we know. Several commentaries have suggested that the reason Chazal forbade reading Sifrei Chitzonim was only in their time. Because while they were canonizing things, they had to make it clear what was in and what was out. Afterwards, you can read it as long as you understand that it's out. Hence, they also quote Ben Sira. Maccabees is interesting, because the simple reason why Maccabees is not in Tanakh is not for any of those reasons, but simply...
It's too late.
Yeah, it's too late. That all the canonization happened a long time before that, with the end of Anshei Knesset HaGdola, with the end of Nevuah and the assumption of divine inspiration, and all the things that Chazal self-understood was happening at the end of that period. They just didn't have that by the time you got to Hanukkah, by the time you got to Maccabees. So even if Maccabees theoretically should get in, Maccabees didn't get in. It's not canonized, because it's just after the period of canonization. That's just... So it's an interesting book in that way, because there's nothing at face value which is theologically problematic. It's just late. It's just late. There are many books we have that are late. You know, it was, you know,
when did he say the last books were canonized?
At the beginning of the second, right? Second Temple. Right? Right, you think about the last books. Right, the last books of Tanakh are Esther, are Ezra Nehemiah, are Divrei Hayamim, which is a retrospective. It's Haggai, it's Malachi, right? All these books that are happening, the beginning of Bayit
Sheni. What was the role of Chazal in compiling the
Treyasar? Depends which book. Those are over. Those take place over a long period of time. Right. Right. Haggai is very late.
Right, those are the later ones.
So the same with all of them. They sit down, they decide whether the book belongs to Tanakh, and then, if yes, they put it in. It's the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, which is this catch-all phrase for, you know, a century plus worth of Talmidei Chachamim, etc. But the Book of Maccabees is after this. This is just not... Right, it's a different problem. It's just late. It's just later. Now, this, the Rav pointed out once, that the Rambam, this is like a very not lumdish vort by the Rav, but it's obviously true. The Rambam in Hilchos Chanukah incorporates the history of Chanukah. He gives a little bit of history of Chanukah at the beginning of Hilchos Chanukah. And then everyone asks the question, why isn't the Rambam a halachic book? So some people will say, when it comes to Chanukah, knowledge of the history is part of... That's not the simple pshat. The simple pshat is that Mishneh Torah is... What does the Rambam say Mishneh Torah is?
The only book you need
besides for Tanakh. But every other holiday, if you have Tanakh, you know what happened in it. Chanukah you don't, because there's no book in Tanakh. And therefore, he needs to give you the brief history at the beginning of Elul Chanukah, because otherwise you won't know everything else. You just look at Tanakh. Right? That's the simple pshat as to why it's there. This is not... but we do have the Book of Maccabees, and therefore it is helpful to read the Book of Maccabees to understand what's going on. Now, just a few more words about it. I'll take your question in a minute. Sure. Book of Maccabees, again, we only have it in translation, so it's hard to fully know what he was saying. But here's the thing with the Book of Maccabees. It is clearly written from somebody. We have no idea who it is. We don't know who wrote it. It's clearly a frum Jew in the time of the Chanukah story, and you will see that it feels very Tanakh-like. Maccabees 1 feels very Tanakh-like. He is really frum, and the way he writes is Tanakh-like, and what we're going to do...
I mean frum.
He's very frum. And like other book, like books that are actually in Tanakh, in order to make his point, what does he do? He alludes. There is an intertextual... intertextual allusions with other stories in Tanakh, and to understand what he's doing, you need to know what he's talking about. Because, presumably, we can't prove this, but presumably author of Maccabees assumed this would make it into Tanakh. Or something like that, because we know that this is post-canonization. You only know that it's post-canonization if you live afterwards and you know that that we stopped canonizing books. You don't necessarily know that at that point, because... other Jews are still canonizing. Remember, the Christians the early Christians are still Jews. They're still within the community. They are still canonizing.
Right. The early Christians are in the times of the Greeks. No.
What?
Yeah. The early Christians are in the times of the Romans. No.
This is later.
You have Christians. You have the Essenes. You have the Qumranites. You have all these different sects. My point is that there are Jews that are still canonizing for a long time. Meaning, it's not obvious that canonization is over because other Jews and Jewish derivative groups are still canonizing. Right? You have all these books that are post-Tanakh that become canonized by other Jews. So, he didn't necessarily know that this wouldn't be canonized. And as is clear from the canonization discussions in the Gemara, it's not like anybody really knew in advance, right? Yechezkel almost didn't make it in. Kohelet almost didn't make it in, right? Like, this was a process. Shabbos, there's a discussion Yadayim in the Mishnayot. It comes up several places. This is not.
Seriously, you're right.
What?
I mean, just minor point, but he was like, what? There aren't Christians.
No, you're right. The Christians
this
are...
This is 200 BC.
No, this is before Christians. My point is not that the Christians are canonizing it then. My point is that Jews are Jews and Jewish derivative groups are canonizing for a long time. That's my point. Not that Christians are canonizing this at the time of this. This is way too early. Yes. I don't. That apparently was not clear. Let me try that again. Jews and Jewish derivative groups will be canonizing for a long time, as you see from the fact that the Christians are still doing. No, as you see, my point is that they are still. Meaning, there's no reason for anybody to know the canonization is over, because it's not over for all Jews. Chazal have stopped canonizing, but there doesn't seem to be. There's no indication in the Gemara that there was a moment at which Chazal said, we have now stopped canonizing. Right? They just stopped canonizing at some point. It's not, they didn't know in advance. Right? It was not clear how many books would be in Tanakh. Right? There are many books that we love in Tanakh that just almost didn't make it in. That's not my description. That's the Gemara's description. This almost didn't make it in if it weren't for if it weren't for the fact that he stayed up all night and pored over it and resolved all the contradictions and, you know, etc. Yeah.
Apocrypha.
So some of them were lost in history. Some of them were incorporated into other canons, and we still have different Christian groups and etc. Right, meaning Lilith, Tobias, Judith, all types of fascinating books. They are fascinating. Jubilees. These books are amazing, right? They're so much fun to read. They are wild. There are stories of dragons. It's amazing, right? There are like additions to Daniel. It is like. There are wild things happening in the Apocrypha. There are wild things happening in the Pseudepigrapha. It is like Pseudepigrapha are things that are books that are ascribed to a different author, right? That are written as if, like the Wisdom of Solomon, is written on the pretense that it was written by Shlomo HaMelech. That's called Pseudepigrapha, right? Apocrypha is just books that are not canonized.
This is Apocrypha.
Right? This is Apocrypha, yeah.
Right, so when we look
at... It's not pseudo-apocryphal because it isn't described to anybody, right? It's not... There's no pseudo-anything.
When we, meaning modern Jews, look at it, to what extent... Right, like, how do you read it? Do you just read it like a history book?
So what we're going to do is, no, we're not going to read it like a history book. We're going to read it also like a history book, but we're going to read it like... And this is... and a lot of the things I'll say, though not everything, are influenced by... a series of shirim that David Foreman had on the book, where he noted the Tanakh resonances here. We're going to read this on the following assumption. That the person writing it was someone steeped in Tanakh, and therefore, he wrote it like anybody else who's steeped in Tanakh. They wanted you to read it religiously. And in order to do that, they hint at things, and they put it in dialogue with other things in Tanakh in order to make a point, just like Tanakh does to itself. Because, again, the assumption here is that the person writing it didn't necessarily know that this would not be canonized. And to be fair, even if he knew it wouldn't be canonized, that doesn't mean he knew it wouldn't be important, right? He didn't know, like, he had no way of knowing. Presumably, this was important. This was an important miracle that they made a holiday about, and there had to be a record, like everything else that we have.
With a follow-up?
Yeah.
I mean, kind of follow-up, maybe tangential, whatever. Is it possible for an author to write something with Ruach HaKodesh but not make it into Tanakh?
Yeah, why not?
So could this theoretically have been written with Ruach?
Yeah, look, I don't know what Ruach HaKodesh means exactly, but look, no one has... People continuously claim that many things were written with Ruach HaKodesh that are not canonized. The Gemara, to this day, they say it about Rashi. Right? People will say, Rashi is so important, he's the last book written by Ruach HaKodesh. Shulchan Aruch is so important, the last book written by Ruach HaKodesh. Then they'll say about modern Hasidic Rebbes, he has Ruach HaKodesh. No one's saying that their book should be canonized. But, of course, meaning, what does Ruach HaKodesh mean? Some sort of divine inspiration? Sure. Is it possible that this is written with some sort of divine inspiration? Sure. Do I know that that's true? I have no idea. Is this clearly a religious text written by someone who's steeped in the theology of Tanakh and is not, unlike other apocryphal works, against the theology of Tanakh? Yeah. Is the best explanation for why this is not a part of Tanakh simply the fact that it was late? Yeah. Right. Again, if someone said to you, and people say all the time, Rashi is written in Ruach HaKodesh. No one's claiming that means that Perish Rashi should be literally part of Chumash. Maybe they think you have to read it that way, but they don't think the text is part of Chumash. You know, but it wasn't just Jews. Right? It's not just Jews, by the way. The Christians loved Rashi. They were obsessed with Rashi. When I went to an exhibit at the Jewish Museum on the Upper East Side a few years ago. I went for the Rambam manuscript thing, but they have it's amazing. They have these like medieval Christian Bibles which are Latin, but with Perish Rashi in the bottom. because they were obsessed. They were obsessed. Everyone loved Rashi. Wasn't this dude? Everyone loved Rashi.
But did they learn Rashi literally? Like,
yeah. They loved him.
As was not literally.
The Christian Hebraists writing hundreds of years later are still learning Gemara, learning Rambam. Literally, the founding fathers of America are influenced, you know this, by the Christian Hebraists who are literally just reading Rambam and quoting Rambam. Like, as proofs.
Wait, where?
What?
I guess it was...
What do you mean?
The Christian Hebraists?
The founding fathers are influenced by the Christian Hebraists, and the Christian Hebraists, Erasmus, and people like that, who are literally just reading Rambam. They're quoting Rambam. This is not like a guess. We know this. They quote Maimonides.
That's the great question.
Yes, they're making argument whether kingship is mutter based on the Rambam, based on the Gemara. Common sense. But you know common sense?
Yes.
Thomas Paine is literally an extended analysis of Sefer Shmuel. The middle of it, the centerpiece of it, is an extended analysis of Sefer Shmuel, and he's not the only one. The Christian Hebraists are doing this, and they are quoting Gemaras, and they're quoting Midrashim, and they don't necessarily know what they're quoting.
Like Gemara or Mishnah.
Because they...
Mishnah is post-Jesus.
Yeah, so what?
Didn't
no, he, that's a very...
He didn't see eye to eye with the Pharisees. Though.
Doesn't matter. Don't you know... Okay, guys, if you ever read early or even late Christian texts, you'll discover that many of them will say, the Pharisees are terrible people, but you have to listen to a lot of what they say because they have the Masorah. I kid you not, these are anti-Pharisaic texts. But they will say that because they believe that... Just because they believe that we were bad for not accepting... Right? Doesn't mean that they don't think we have... legitimate interpretations of Tanakh. They again, these are divergences, but the Christian Hebraists were very into this.
So we were right until Jesus came.
No, some of them think we were right even afterwards on some things, just not on the fact that we didn't accept Jesus, but they thought we were right about other things, so they continued to care. And this is true of the early ones. Yeah, you find this in fascinating early. There are Christian texts that quote like that have equivalents of Pirkei Avos going through the Masorah. It's fascinating. There are a lot of fascinating stuff going on. The Puritans were like this. The Puritans really cared about Tanakh. They care about Tanakh, but they even cared about Jewish interpretation. This is not like okay. That is a fascinating discussion for another time. You could have, if you, I don't know if you caught this little sort of like 20-second back and forth between me and Mayor Soloveitchik when he was here about this, because he loves spending time on this. When I was in the seminar, we spent a lot of time on this, and Eric Nelson at Harvard wrote a book just on this, just on showing the influence of Chazal on the Christian Hebraists, and then in turn on the founding of the United States.
Why you went along
with the Christian Hebraists? That sounds like a good answer to me.
No, they took a source book. Yeah, they made a source book based on that. Yes. You say that cynically. No, they made a source book so you can see the original sources. That's a very good thing. I don't know. Like, I don't think that's a cynical thing. I think that's actually an amazing thing to do. What? I don't know. Yes, that argument. Mayor Soloveitchik, since that course, has been taking those sources, putting them together into a reader so that you can see them in the original. He is Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's grandson, so he's the Rav is his
great uncle.
Talk to Yosef later. You can figure out. I don't know. You can explain the whole family tree. I don't know. Okay. With that, let us begin looking at the Book of Maccabees. Okay. We will not necessarily read all of it cover to cover. But you have it, and you can read it. And no, we have no idea. Some Jew, I don't know. What? I think I will. Yeah.
One of these might be mistaken or something. If I can try printing more, but I
printed a bunch, but the printer is really acting up. There's nothing you can do about it. Okay, ready, guys?
Yes.
Book of Maccabees. Okay. So, Book of Maccabees. After Alexander, son of Philip of Macedonian, who came from the land of Kittim, had defeated King Darius of the Persians and the Medes, he succeeded him as king. Yes, Darius. He had previously become king of Greece. He fought many battles, conquered strongholds, and put to death the kings of the earth. He advanced to the ends of the earth and plundered many nations. When the earth became quiet before him, he was exalted and his heart was lifted up. He gathered a very strong army and ruled over countries, nations, and princes, and they became tributary to him. After this, he fell sick and perceived that he was dying. So he summoned his most honored officers, who had been brought up with him from youth, and divided his kingdom among them while he was still alive. After Alexander had reigned 12 years, he died. Then his officers began to rule, each in his own place. They all put on crowns after his death, and so did their descendants after them for many years, and caused many evils on the earth. Okay, this is something, by the way, we find in Chazal. Also, Chazal, like Alexander to an extent, hence Alexander becomes a Jewish name. Right, this is a very old phenomenon. This is not new. This is true since the time of Alexander the Great. They sort of liked Alexander. They didn't necessarily like the people who came after Alexander, who was not Alexander. Okay? Good. From them came forth a sinful root. That is obviously very biblical. That phrase comes from Dvarim. Pared Rosh Vilana, things like that. We talk about people as bad roots, you know, in Nitzavim. No? Come on. Right? Penyesh Bechem Shoresh Pared Rosh Vilana. Right? A bad root, a root of gall, right? These are images that we use in Tanakh. Okay. Antiochus Epiphanes, son of King Antiochus, he had been hostage in Rome. He began to reign in the 137th year of the kingdom of the Greeks. In those days, certain renegades came out from Israel and misled many, saying, "Let us go and make a covenant with the Gentiles around us, for since we separated from them, many disasters have come upon us." Right. So here we get the beginning of the backstory, which is things start going downhill when what happens? People believe that bad things have happened because they've gone against the Gentiles. This is like a classic Tanakh thing, right? Things are bad because they miss what's going on. They miss the theological reasons for what's going on, and they always mess it up. Things are bad because we're not enough integrated with the Gentiles. Let's make a covenant with them. So this proposal pleased them, and some of the people eager went to the king, who authorized them to observe the ordinances of the Gentiles. So they built a gymnasium in Jerusalem according to Gentile custom, and removed the marks of circumcision and abandoned the Holy Covenant. They joined with the Gentiles and sold themselves to do evil. And this is one of the things that you hear in Chazal. The one of the things Chazal are angriest about are the reversal of the Brit Milah, which was a very not enjoyable process, but people would perform some sort of surgery. At the moment, the English word for it escapes me. It's
actually reversal.
Yes.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, you can do that.
No, no, it has a word. You can look it up, but it had to do with like hanging weights on the remaining skin that might be used in the foreskin and stretching it out. It was not exactly a pleasant procedure, but this is what people were doing to reverse it. And when Chazal talk about this, right, people who reverse their milah, they mean that literally, and they say that those people have no chelek in amava. This is what they're talking about, right? People who mamish wanted to be, who fit in with the and it's some very fancy word. It's terrible.
I never heard of it.
Yeah, it's terrible. Anyways, when Antiochus saw that the kingdom was established, he determined to become king of Egypt in order that he might reign over both kingdoms, right? So we know that this is the background, right? That the Greeks try to take over the Egyptians. They, what?
Epispasm.
There we go. Epispasm?
Epispasm.
Yeah. Something like that. I can never get it out right. But there's a word for it. Okay. So he invaded Egypt with a strong force. Now remember, guys, remember when Chazal talked about the decrees that they set up, like no Brit Milah? But this is the beginnings of this, that the Jews who are integrating are the battles with the Brit Milah. Why is the battle with the Brit Milah?
I guess like
the Greeks are very into their bodies. That's exactly it. Right, the Greeks are very into their bodies. It's the new body.
I was going to say that's the second reason. The first reason why Chazal fight so hard, the second reason is why they push so hard.
No, I'm saying the reason that this particular is the way that they express it is because the Greeks are into their physical body in the nude. Right, they celebrate the nude body.
Yeah, so
right, hence the right. What was the ultimate expression of the Greek obsession with the nude body?
The Olympics.
The Olympics. Thank you. The Olympics. Right, the Olympics. Right, the Olympics. The nude Olympics. Which Ad Hayom, is it Princeton or Yale? One of them still has nude Olympics to commemorate it, like every year. It's very weird. It's very strange. I don't remember which one it is.
Definitely yells a lot more into the
nude. I'm trying to remember which one it was. I think you're right. It's Yale, but someone's going to yell at me and say, "No, it's Princeton or Mitt." I don't know. I think it was Yale. I don't know. Again, I don't know if it's official. I don't remember exactly the details. I try to avoid it, but I remember that this is the case. Okay. So he invaded Egypt with a strong force, the chariots and elephants and cavalry, and with a large fleet. Yes, they really did use battle elephants. They really did. This is actually what happened historically. This is actually true. What? I don't know. Haven't you ever, like, watched Lord of the Rings? This is why you have to watch Lord of the Rings. But, what?
That's the point.
No, no, also watch. No. People who know me know I'm a big fan of the books. I'm also a big fan of movies. No. I fully believe that if you want to fully understand Sefer Shmuel, you have to watch the movies and realize the biblical implications, then you will understand it in a much deeper way. I gave this share at the buy-in. It was fun. And I've talked about this as a possible mishmar topic. I was debating whether to do that as this mishmar is my Lord of the Rings and Navi, because you really can't understand. Lord of the Rings very much helps you understand Navi, but not right now. I think so, but I insist on all three. Though if you watch it, I insist on you watching all three. Just for the record.
Director's cut. So it's like 12 hours.
What? We can have that mishmar. We just need to find time. Maybe in the new apartment. Which is apparently a mansion. We'll have a movie night.
No one's in that.
See, I don't know if I want to do that, but in one of the apartments, we'll borrow the yeshiva's projector and we'll do a movie night and then what?
So we'll do it in the new one. We'll do it.
I don't think that's true. You can put it on a wall. You sit on the on the couches, get some sleeping bags, sit on the floor. We're fine. Okay, we'll do it in the spring and we'll do it outside in the park. Okay, like we do all over Israel. We do that in Efrat. Like just put it on a big white wall. Okay, I don't know. Movie in a, I don't know. Come up with something. Okay, good. Guys, anyways, so he engaged King Ptolemy of Egypt in battle, and Ptolemy turned and fled before him, and many were wounded and fell. They captured and fortified cities in the land of Egypt, and he plundered the land of Egypt. Okay, guys. After subduing Egypt, Antiochus returned in the 143rd year. He went up against Israel and came to Jerusalem with a strong force. He arrogantly entered the temple and took the gold altar, the lampstand for the light, and its utensils. Okay, this is the background that we all know, the story. Or this is the story, right? Not everything should be a chiddush to you, but now you see how we know this stuff. He took also the table for the bread of the presence, meaning he took the shulchan, he took the menorah, right? The cups for drink offerings, the bowls, the golden censers, the curtain, the crowns, the gold decoration in the front of the temple. He stripped it all off. He took the silver and the gold and the costly vessels. He took also the hidden treasures that he found. Taking them all, he went into his own land. He shed much blood and spoke with great arrogance. Which, as we all know, that is the ultimate sin of a king in Tanakh. Be it Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel, be it Belshazzar in Daniel, be it Assyria, be it Mitzrayim, be it pretty much anybody. Whenever a king is described as being arrogant, you know that in the eyes of Tanakh, that means the next thing you're going to find is he's going to be beaten down by God miraculously. That's just the way Tanakh works. And that's going to happen here as well. Israel mourned deeply in every community. Rulers and elders groaned. Young men became faint. The beauty of the women faded. Every bridegroom took up the lament. She who sat in the bridal chamber was mourning. Even the land trembled for its inhabitants. And all the house of Jacob was closed with shame. These are all other references in Tanakh of mourning, but that should be obvious. 2 years later, the king sent to the cities of Judah a chief collector of tribute, and he came to Jerusalem with a large force. Now, here is the first thing that should not be obvious. Until now, this is history. You see some Tanakh references, but here there's something which is very, very, very odd. How many people would think that if you came with an army, what you would do is send the tax collector? Now, you might, if the primary thing you wanted to do was collect taxes. But here's really Forman's speculation, and we have to go backwards, because remember we're translating from the Greek. In Hebrew, how do you say tax collector in Tanakh? Yeah, so in the full phrase is? Sarei Misim. Where is that from? It's from Mitzrayim. It's from Mitzrayim. Right? Sarei Misim. Which means that, why might this phrase be used to tell you that this is about to be a story that is going to resonate with the theology of Mitzrayim? Which should not surprise you, because, as I said, there are certain tropes that Tanakh emphasizes, like arrogant kings who think they're greater than God, who, that is the beginning of their demise. If Paro is not the... Right, Paro is one of the first, and most straightforward examples of this, where, you know, half of Sefer Shmot is just about this theme. Yes, I don't think that anything's finished you, but that word may be hinting to the fact that this is going, that to fully understand what's going on, you have to keep that story in mind. So deceitfully, he spoke peaceable words with them, and they believed him, but he suddenly fell upon the city, dealt a severe blow, and destroyed many people of Israel. He plundered the city, burned it with fire, tore down its houses and surrounding walls. They took captive the women and children and seized the livestock. Then they fortified the city of David with a great strong wall and strong towers and became their citadel. They stationed there a sinful people, men who were renegades. They strengthened their position, they stored up arms and food, and collecting the spoils of Jerusalem, they stored them there and became a great menace, for the citadel became an ambush against the temple, an evil adversary of Israel at all times. Right, so here we hear about who are the enemies of the Jews at this point? The Jews. The Jews. The renegade Jews. That's their biggest enemy. When you visit, right, when people say that the enemy in the Hanukkah story is not just the Greeks, it's the Mityavnim, it's the Hellenized Jews, that's true. That's what it says in the Book of Maccabees. Right, those, they're the renegades. Now, it also may be that there's a bit of a machloket about this. When the Gemara yells about people who learn Chachma Yevanit, right, some people think that's about philosophy. The many Rishonim think that's not about philosophy. It's about learning Greek language and the customs of the court, because that was what people did when they became traders.
So it's a sort of mod Yevanit?
Chachma Yevanit, or whatever Chachma Yevanit means, right? Whether, right? Some people, obviously, who didn't like the Rambam Udi Mei, thought it meant Greek philosophy, but many others thought it meant certain, for your share.
Also, like, over that, like, you want to be able to learn how to speak modern Greek without, like, getting an issue? Or?
Again, not a discussion for now. But, no, not the language, per se. It's Chochma Yevanit. Anyways, on every side of the temple, they shed innocent blood. They even defiled the temple. Because of them, the residents of Jerusalem fled. She became a dwelling of strangers. She became strange to her offspring, and her children forsook her. This should all remind you of what books. These are quotes. Echa, thank you. This is obvious. But at this point, by the way, there's not so many chiddushim in the first paragraph, but how many people at this point, if you didn't know that this wasn't Tanakh, would feel like you're reading a translation of a book in Tanakh?
Yeah.
Right. This sounds very biblical. This is not like, this is clearly someone who's writing that way. Her temple became desolate like a desert. These are quotes. Shamimah kamidbar. Her feast returned into mourning. These are literal quotes from Echa.
Yeah.
You know that, right?
Die hard to not fiction.
What? Yes, that's exactly what it is, yeah. Well, not fiction, but true, yeah, whatever. I don't know. I don't know. Her dishonor now grew as great as her glory. Her exaltation turned into mourning. These are all quotes from Echa, right? Right? You should recognize these quotes from Echa to the extent that all of you are conversant in Echa. These images, no?
Yes.
It's morning. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and that all should give up their particular customs. And now we get the beginning of the story we really all know in Hanukkah, which is that he imposes
Shmad.
Yeah, he imposes Shmad. He says you have to give up your particular customs. All the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many, even from Israel, gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. So, you know those things that we talk about, that they banned Brit Milah, they banned Shabbat, Avodah Zarah in the Beit HaMikdash, all those things are Pachot HaYoter from this first chapter in Maccabees. The king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the towns of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the temple, to profane Sabbath and festivals, to defile the temple and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and other unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they would forget the law and change all the ordinances. He added, and whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. Antiochus, or his messengers. In such words, he wrote to his whole kingdom. He appointed inspectors over all the people and commanded the towns of Judah to offer sacrifice town by town. Many of the people, everyone who forsook the law, joined them and did evil in the land. They drove Israel into hiding in every place of refuge they had. And on the 15th day of Kislev, in the 145th year, they erected a desolating sacrilege on the altar of burnt sacrifice. They also built altars in the surrounding towns of Judah, and offered incense at the doors of the houses and in the streets. The scroll of the law that they found, they tore to pieces and burned with fire. This is really bad, right? This is really... Anyone found possessing the book of the covenant, or anyone who adhered to the law, was condemned to death by decree of the king. Okay, you know these stories we talk about with Hanukkah, they banned Talmud Torah? All true. This is all true, right? We don't make this up. Right? This is the records from the time of Hanukkah. They kept using violence against Israel, against those who were found month after month in the towns. On the 25th day of the month, they offered sacrifice on the altar that was on top of the altar of sacrifice. According to the decree, they put to death the women who had their sons circumcised and their families, and those who circumcised them. They hung the infants from their mothers' necks. It's very gruesome. But many in Israel stood firm and resolved in their hearts not to eat unclean food. They chose to die rather than be defiled by food or to profane the Holy Covenant, and they did die. Very great wrath came upon Israel. Now here there's an interesting point. Good. So here's the first thing that we have, which is a little bit interesting, which is that they give up their life for eating kosher. Now, you can either say that this is against Chazal, because as we will see, it is clear that in the time of... Now, we have to be clear. In Chazal, it is 100% clear that there is a machlokas about martyrdom, what mitzvot require martyrdom, because Chazal say that in their time there is a vote about it, which means that before that, it was a machlokas. And we will discover that in the time of Maccabees, they still thought that violating Shabbos was Yeharig Ve'al Yavor, and Matityahu is the one who is Mechadesh, that is not the case. But, so one possibility, this is in fact against Chazal, this is an earlier halachic position, what but when Chazal themselves say...
Sacrificing swine to idols.
Or to profit. That's not Yahrag Bal Yavor. Eating not kosher, that's not Yahrag Bal Yavor.
Sacrificing
that. No, that is. But they also refuse, they would rather die than eat not kosher. So you could say against Chazal. The other alternative is not necessarily, because this, at least, follows a position, Chazal, which is Shara Shmad. That when Judaism under attack, everything becomes Yahrag Bal Yavor. Yes. And where the Gemara says, even Arkata Demasane, right, even changing the color of your shoelaces becomes Yahrag Bal Yavor. So this is clearly within... What?
That's the Gemara.
Yes.
Wait,
what is that? Sanhedrin Ayin Dalet, yes.
If that was Oreo shoe,
good to know. Yes. The Gemara's phrase is Arkata Demasane.
Rabbi, what does that even mean? There's no halacha on what color.
Correct. It's even things that are not halachic. Even if... The way Rashi understands is that even things that are mere cultural markers of Judaism, if they tell you to change them in order to reflect that you are giving up your Judaism, then you have to die rather than do it, because it's... Because not about the mitzvah per se. It's about the chil Hashem Shabbos. So it doesn't matter whether it's a formal halachic chiyuv or not. And therefore, this is, in fact, in consonance with the Chazal accepted halacha. The machloka that we will find here about whether or not you should be machal Shabbos rather than or die, that clearly is against Chazal's conclusion, but the Book of Maccabees ends up having the same maskana as Chazal, but not the same Havamina. Yes, all right.
What's the difference between the scroll of the law and the covenant?
I mean, these are different phrases that we have that are Sefer HaBrit.
You're talking about
right, Luchot Ha'idut. Right, I mean these are books or Sefer Ha'idut. Right, these are all phrases you have in Tanakh. Eidut. Again, this is a translation of the Greek, which is translated. Yeah.
They're used in this one sentence after another.
Correct, but in Tanakh you have that also. That sometimes we'll call it the Sefer Abrid, sometimes we'll call it the Eidut. Yeah. Right, the Eidut, Chokim. But we have all these words for Torah.
Not one sentence after another. Like
we will. Yeah we will. Right, Eidut, Mishpatim, Chokim. Yeah. Torah, Va'Mitzvah, Va'Luchim. Right, Chokim. Right. This is two steps removed. Right. This is translation of the Greek, which is translation of the Hebrew. So what exact phrase are you using? But these are all things that can translate into to Chumash. That's not. No, we don't have. You missed that at the beginning. We don't have it. We only have the Greek and translations of the Greek, but we've lost the Hebrew. The Hebrew has been lost to time. Yes, probably. We assume it did. Meaning, there's no reason to assume that it wasn't originally in Hebrew. That's what they were speaking. Okay, chapter 2.
Unless it was written later.
What?
Unless it was written later.
Yeah, but there's no particular reason to believe that. Meaning. Many things in the Septuagint, I mean, the standard academic view is that it was written in Hebrew and all that exists is the Greek translation in the Septuagint. The Septuagint is mostly translations of Hebrew text into the Greek. There's no reason to believe this is any different. Right? It's not like we just found a Greek book and said it must have originally been Hebrew. It's we found it in the Septuagint, which is a translation of Hebrew books. Like, there's no reason to believe this isn't written in Hebrew originally. Like, it's just lost to time.
One thing, And the Septuagint includes Elder Apocrypha.
Correct. I mean, it also includes Tanakh. I mean, okay. Now things get even more Tanakhi when you get to the second chapter of Maccabees. And here's where you get the spiritual rebellion. In those days, Mattathias, son of John, son of Simeon, a priest of the family of Yoariv, moved from Jerusalem and settled in Modian. Welcome! Yay! Welcome!
Yay!
Yay! Yay! Yay. Yay. You didn't know that? You didn't know that the great battles of them happened here?
Modin Maccabees.
Welcome to... And it was worth reading it for this. Yes, the battles happened here. Thank you. This! The battles, right, it all begins here in Modin. Okay, this is I didn't know this was a secret. The battles begin in Modin. They were fought all over the place, but they started here in Modin. That's what they did, okay? I didn't make this up. This is not like a tour guide like tidbit. We think it happened right here. No, it happened in Modin.
Let's read it.
It starts here. Okay. He had five sons. What? Yes.
I didn't want to assume anything
because
I can never know.
That's why Chashmonaim is right here.
Yeah.
That's why the things in the area are called. Israel is very much like that. They're very into this. There were a bunch of battles were in the Gush also, which is why a lot of things they are named there. But you know, because those are also Harei Yehuda. It's all over the mountains.
Just a note on the language. It was almost definitely written in Hebrew, apparently, because there's Hebrew idioms, which
were... this is written in Hebrew. They're not like... I said I can't promise you it was written in Hebrew, but this is not like the Frum people say it's written.
I would look at it exactly in days when they found an olive press here in Modin,
were
exactly a day's walk from Yerushalayim.
Yeah, there's plenty of archaeological evidence of such things.
Does the version you have, the translation of the Greek version, does it start like some lines, a paragraph of just "and"? Because that would be a very clear marker.
Look, this is a translation of the Greek. I don't know. I don't speak Greek. I don't know. There are different translations. This is the one that I found online that's easiest to print. I don't know. I honestly don't know. Again, this is not like a controversial thing. This is not like some academics think it was originally written in Greek, something in Hebrew, and I'm taking the Frum view. No. Pretty much everybody thinks it was written in Hebrew.
You said you would have promised me. You could definitely promise.
It was written in
Yiddish. I can't promise you because we don't have the Hebrew version, so it could be that it wasn't, for all I know.
We found the Hebrew version.
Correct. I'll be honest. No, we have certain Hebrew versions now, but they're translations. Right. They're back translations of the Greek. We don't have an original Hebrew. Right, that's not the issue.
Written Yiddish here.
Yes, exactly. It's written Yiddish. In Echonami. He had five sons: John, surnamed Gadi; Simon, called Tasi; Judah, called Maccabee; Eliezer, called Avaran; and Jonathan, called Abfus. He saw the blasphemies being committed in Judah and Jerusalem, and said, "Alas, why was I born to see this, the ruin of my people, the ruin of the holy city, and to live there when it was given over to the enemy, the temple given over to aliens?" These are obviously all quotes from Tanakh. You should all recognize these, right? But this is not a chiddush. These are all... Batenu lin nachrim. These are all quotes from Yirmiyahu, from Eicha. Come on.
We saw that in the Haftarah a couple weeks ago.
Yes. Her temple has become like a person without honor. Okay. People, I do not remember Eicha. Oh, God. Honestly. Of course I remember.
Not when we read it in the whole place.
Who reads Eicha
in English? We only read it in
English. Who reads Eicha?
Don't read Eicha.
Okay, I'm going to read the beginning of Eicha. Eicha yeshva badar. A year rabat yamaitak amana rabata begim sarit ben yod aita lamas. Right?
No, Paley.
What?
Right?
Stop talking.
Yeah, he yeshva bagoyim, lo matzav anoach, kol reform, hizigo ben amitzarim. Right? Vayitzei mi bat zion kol hadara. Right, gone from all of Zion is her glory. Right? Right? Right. Kol machamadash, are you mimikedem in flame of Yatzar, Venozer Laho, right? There's no one to help her. Kol mechab. Let's see. Let's get some other ones.
Stop for a second. All of Yoda is now all of Weeb.
Whatever, it's fine.
Anyways, right? If you go through, this is not like this. It shouldn't surprise you. These are like quotes from Eicha and similar things, Yirmiyahu and the like. Her temple has become like a person without honor. Her glorious vessels have been carried into exile. Her infants have been killed in her streets. Her youth by the sword of the foe. What nation has not inherited her palaces? Has not seized her spoils? Right? That's right. Ruma chovai betulotai v'chorei halchu v'ashevi. Right? The children have gone. Right? These are all Eicha, things like that. All her adornment has been taken away, no longer free, she's become a slave, and see, our holy place, our beauty, our glory has been laid waste, the Gentiles have profaned them, why should we live any longer? Right, this is a bit more Eov, but okay, or Yirmiyahu. Then Mattathias and his sons tore their clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned greatly. The king's officers who were enforcing the apostasy came to the town of Modian to make them offer sacrifice. And here's the great drama of Modian. Many from Israel came to them, and Mattathias and his sons were assembled. And the king's officer spoke to Mattathias as follows. He offers him a choice. You are a leader, honored and great in this town and supported by sons and brothers. Now be the first to come and do what the king commands, as all the Gentiles and the people of Judah and those who are left in Jerusalem have done. Then you and your sons will be numbered among the friends of the king, and you and your sons will be honored with silver and gold and many gifts. Mattathias answered and said in a loud voice, even if all the nations that live under the rule of the king obey him and have chosen to obey his commandments, every one of them abandoning the religion of their fathers, I and my sons and my brothers will continue to live by the covenant of our fathers. Far be it from us to desert the law and the ordinances. We will not obey the king's word by turning aside from the religion to the right hand or the left. Right? Right, this is right, yes, this is Lotasser, right? We will not move left or right. Very good. When he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer a sacrifice in the altar on the altar in Modian according to the king's command. When Mattathias saw it, he burned with zeal, and his heart was stirred. He gave vent to his righteous anger. By the way, what is this a quote of? Who is he clearly at this point? Pinchas. He's Pinchas. He is. Right, this is. Right, Kano et Kinati. Right?
Can you kill people to do it?
Now, remember, what imagery is about to be invoked? What imagery do you know is about to be invoked? Pinchas, Moshe, because who are these? Who are they? These are Kohanim. These are Kohanim. These are people from Levi and what in the book? Thank you, the Egel. This is an Egel moment. This is an Egel moment. Literally, right? The Jews are about to sacrifice an idol, and you have Leviim and Kohanim, who are, according to the way many of Mepharshim understand it, what are Kohanim and Leviim known for? And what are they willing to do to prevent Avodah Zarah?
Kill people.
Kill who?
Everyone.
Their family. Haomer laviv limo. Right.
Well, achiv.
Come on.
Haomer.
Why is it once we know this guy?
Ki ashamru imro techo ritcha yinzoru. Because they will kill their relatives. Why? Because they keep the law and the covenant. Do you hear those words resonating here? You should, right? Moshe, Pinchas, right?
What about them?
They kill people. That's called. That's what you're supposed to do in this situation. Yes.
No one warned this guy.
What? They don't warn them. You don't warn them.
It's an extrajudicial.
Yeah. Sometimes that's what's called. That's what you know from the Egel. That's what you know from Pinchas. That's exactly what's about to happen.
It's like a.
And guess. Take a wild guess. Who he is going to quote? Literally quote, guys. Guys, who do you think he's going to quote?
Phineas.
Wait, in this case, he's actually going to quote Moshe. He's literally going to quote Moshe because what does Moshe say at the Egel? What are his exact words?
Let everyone.
What is your in Tanakh? What are Moshe's words? Me, Lashem, Eli. Whoever is for God, come to me. So what does he do? He gave vent to his righteous anger. He ran and he killed him on the altar. At the same time, he killed the king's officer who was forcing them to sacrifice, and he tore down the altar. And if the reference to Pinchas wasn't clear enough, thus he burned with zeal for the law, just as Pinchas did against Zimri, son of Salu. Right? If you are missing the fact that this guy is in conversation with Tanakh, he's telling you, yes, he is the heir to Pinchas. He is a Kohen, and he is Pinchas, because of course he's Pinchas. And according to Chazal, who is Pinchas imitating?
Moses.
Moshe, right? Because remember, Pinchas in the Gemara, Pinchas comes to Moshe and he says, didn't you teach us that Habol Aramit Kanaim Pogimbo? And what did Moshe say to him?
You are right.
And he who reads the letter should carry out the deed. Go. And he goes with his spear and he kills Zimri. So he's following the lessons of Moshe from the Egel. So Mattathias cried out in the town with a loud voice, saying, let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me, or in Hebrew, Mi Lashem. Right? Torato. Right? Eli. Then he and his sons fled to the hills and left all that they had in the town. So here, if you have not yet been convinced that this is a very Tanakh-influenced book, he is telling you that this is a book that in order to understand it, you have to be steeped in the theology of Tanakh, where he says, yes, welcome. This is Egel time 2. This is Pinchas time 2. These people are the heirs, the proper heirs, to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Pinchas. They are the heirs of the Kohanim.
Rabbi, don't you think it's so weird that it's, it like says, oh, and they left all their stuff in the town?
Why is that weird?
Like, it never says that anywhere.
Of course it does.
Like, oh, and they happen to leave their stuff. Like,
of course it does.
You
just don't play
instruments. What do you mean, David Amela?
Like,
you just noticed? What do you mean? When it often does.
He just pulled it.
When? Yeah, like, when else does it add that detail? Like,
what do you mean, when David's fleeing, they leave everything behind? Or these are like...
Yeah.
No, I mean, as a point, like, my point is, like, it seems like...
Oh, I don't think so. I don't know, maybe they're speaking to, but I don't think it's crazy. At that time, many were seeking righteousness and justice when doubt... Now, that is, of course, people who were what? What is the Hebrew of that? Yeah, they were Doresh Tzedek U'Mishpat. Right? This is very... Went down to the wilderness to live there. They, their sons, their wives, their livestock, because troubles pressed heavily upon them. It was reported to the king's officers and to the troops in Jerusalem, the city of David, that those who had rejected the king's command and gone down into hiding places in the wilderness, many pursued them and overtook them. Now, by the way, this also is very much... This isn't just... Which images of Moshe does this remind you of? Not just Moshe the Egel, but which other Moshe moments? Right, when he kills somebody in a fit of righteous indignation and ends up having to flee to the Midbar. Right, this is very much, the imagery here is clearly very much Moshe. Right, these are people who are willing to stand up for what's right and flee, if that's what it takes. Many pursued them and overtook them. They encamped opposite them. And here's where you see this interesting halachic point. And this is where you see the machlokes about Yehareg Val Yavor. They encamped opposite them and prepared for battle against them on the Sabbath day. They said to them, enough of this. Come out and do what the king commands and you will live. But they said, we will not come out, nor will we do what the king commands and so profane the Sabbath day. Then the enemy quickly attacked them, but they did not answer them or hurl a stone at them or block up in their hiding place. For they said, let us all die in our innocence, heaven and earth testify for us that you are killing us unjustly. So they attacked them on the Sabbath, and they died with their wives and children and livestock to the number of 1,000 people. What?
Why are there 16 more pages?
We're not going to read through all of it, but no, because what happens at this moment? Remember, this is Machlokes in Chazal. Remember, Chazal says Shabbos is unique. Remember that Shabbos is unique.
Yeah.
Shabbos is unique that you need special Teres HaKasuv. I talked about this with Yeshua, because Shabbos is the exception. Right? Shabbos, yes it is. Right? Yes it is Yavro Ve'Yahareg, but the Gemara requires separate drasha because clearly this was not a given. This was a live Machlokes for a long time, but you actually see it playing out here in Maccabees because the Maccabim, why do they end up winning the war? Because they paskin that was the wrong move, that Shabbos is not Yavor, is not Yehareg Val Yavor, it's Yavor Val Yehareg. That's how we know this story, because they didn't all die. Because when Mattathias and his friend learned of it, they mourned for them deeply and all said to their neighbors, If we do all do as our brothers have done and refuse to fight with the Gentiles for our lives and for our ordinances, they will quickly destroy us from the earth. So they made this decision that day. Let us fight against anyone who comes to attack us on the Sabbath day. Let us not all die as our brothers died in their hiding places. And it's amazing, right? When Chazal say that there was a machlokas be'erek v'al-yavr, you'll say, really? How could there be a machlokas about something so important, about what you martyr yourself for? And the answer is, yes, there's a machlokas about that. Look, right? We know these are live machlokas. Yes, we have machloket or anything, but you see, and there are real consequences to this. It's quite bad. Yes.
So, you know, didn't we say in Daniel that when the three went into the fire, they said, you know, we'd rather die, and they didn't trust that God would save them, and they got saved them.
Correct.
This seems like something that looks to me very, you know, surely deserving of like God coming.
Correct, but the point is that they don't always get saved.
What?
Right. That's exactly the point. If every time you said, I don't care if I get saved, God said, oh, I see that you really care and he saved you, then that would not be sincere. The point is, God doesn't always save you. Right? It doesn't always happen. Sometimes you really have to martyr yourself.
That's also, that was
separate. But like, the way you're making it seem is that they died because they tossed their
heart. Correct. Because they could have fought.
How were they supposed to know?
What do you mean? It was a machloket. Not a wrong way. They poskened the way that led to their death. I don't understand the problem. If someone said that Avodah Zarah is Yehargav al-Yavor, so they give up their life, if it turned out they were wrong, right, we poskin differently, then they died. Or even if they're right, they died because of the psak. That's why they died. What's the problem? I mean, that's what happened. Then they united with them a company of Azadeans, mighty warriors of Israel, all who offered themselves willingly for the Lord, and all became fugitives to escape their troubles, join them and reinforce them. They organized an army and struck down sinners in their anger and renegades in their wrath. The survivors fled to the Gentiles for safety. Good times. Mattathias and his friends went around and tore down the altars. They forcibly circumcised all the uncircumcised boys that they found within the borders of Israel. Yes.
Just went around forcibly circumcising.
Yes.
People.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. They hunted down the arrogant, and the work prospered in their hands. They rescued the law out of the hands of the Gentiles and kings, and they never let the sinner gain the upper hand. Now the days drew near for Mattathias to die, and he said to his sons, arrogance have scorned, have now become strong. It is a time of ruin and furious anger. Now, my sons, show zeal for the law. Give your lives for the covenant of our fathers. Remember the deeds of the fathers which they did in their generations, and you will receive great honor and an everlasting name. Was not Abraham found faithful when tested, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness? Joseph, at the time of his distress, kept the commandment and became Lord of Egypt. By the way, this is? What is this? Anyone recognize this? Mishana la from Bahara Maria Yanenu. Mishana le Yosef. Mishana le. Right, this is a very Jewish trope. We just go through everything. The one who answered him, the one who did this, the one who did this, right? We go through Jewish history, right? We do things like this in our tefillah all the time. Pinchas, our father, because he was deeply zealous, received the covenant of everlasting priesthood. Joshua, because he fulfilled the command, became a judge in Israel. Kalev, because he testified in the assembly, received inheritance in the land. David, because he was merciful, inherited the throne of the kingdom forever. Elijah, because of great zeal for the Lord, was taken up into heavens. Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael, believed and were saved from the flames. Daniel, because of innocence, was delivered from the mouth of the lions.
Spoiler, yeah.
Observe from generation to generation that none of those who put their trust in Hashem will lack strength. Do not fear the words of sinners, for their splendor will turn into dung and worms. Today they will be exalted, but tomorrow they will not be found, because they will return to the dust, and their plans will have perished. My sons, be courageous and grow strong in the law, for by it you will gain honor. Here is your brother Simeon, who I know is wise in counsel. Always listen to him. He shall be your father. Judah Maccabee has been a mighty warrior from his youth. He shall command the army for you and fight the battle against the peoples. You shall rally around you all who observe the law and avenge the wrong done to your people. Pay back the Gentiles in full and obey the commandments of the law. Then he blessed them and was gathered into his fathers. He died in 146th year and was buried in the tomb of his fathers at Modi'in, and all Israel mourned for him with great lamentation.
Has anybody ever tried to back
I mean, there are some, yeah, like Hebrew translations, but into biblical Hebrew, I'm not sure. I mean, I honestly don't know. Okay. Okay, we won't necessarily get through all of it, but there are, you know, we have time. So we'll still go through a decent amount more of this here, and we'll start seeing even more Tanakh resonance. They'll help us understand it. But even just reading the story and just making hard along the way is, if you've never done it, it's worth doing. It's just, it's one of those things. Okay, anyone want to take over reading for just a little bit? Let's meet Judah. Let's meet Yehuda Maccabi. He's fun. Who wants to read about Judah? He's great. He's great. He's fun. Come on, this is English. What are you doing? Okay.
Gersley.
Oh, yeah. Now Gorgias took 5,000 infantry.
Wait, where'd you go?
Where'd you go? Oh, yeah.
Chapter 3.
Sorry.
Chapter 3, man.
Okay, sorry. Somehow I got mixed up with this. Then his son Judah, who is called Maccabee, took command in his place. All his brothers and all who had joined his father helped him. They gladly fought for Israel. He extended the glory of his people like a giant he put on his breastplate. He bound on his armor of war and waged battles, protecting the camp by his sword. He was like a lion in his deeds, like a lion's cub roaring for prey.
By the way, where are these references from? Why is it invoking this?
Yeah. Also, his name is Yehuda.
Because Yehuda! He's Yehuda! His name is Yehuda! Come on! God! Where is that pasuk from? What is he quoting?
Is this a bracha? No.
Well, which bracha is it? You always have to remember that in one of the brachot, Yehuda is a lion, the other one it is.
Wait, you know, it says breastplate. Does it have a Kohen breastplate?
Yeah, presumably.
Does it mean like armor?
It's only armor, but.
Wait, which one? Because he's like riding into battle wearing like the Kohen. Like, that's
really
the
structure.
I hope not because he dies.
I'm sure he did.
I'm going to assume. I hope it's armor breastplate. Because I know he does die.
Yeah, so read the pasuk.
He dies in battle.
So read the pasuk.
He really didn't tell me that he died. I would probably have assumed that he probably died sometime between this and now.
Yes, but fighters, he dies in battle, fighting the Greeks.
What is the okay, right? Gur Aryeh Yehuda, Miteref Nialita, Karar Ovitz Karyeh, Uchilavi Mi Kumenu. He's obviously quoting this because his name is Yehuda. But this is not like. This is, you know, there's an obvious reason for this, yes?
Yeah, he searched out and pursued those who broke the law, and he burned those who troubled his people. Lawbreakers shrank back for fear of him, and all the evildoers were confounded, and deliverance prospered by his hand.
By the way, there is something, though, ironic about invoking Yehuda, and that's one of the things that maybe he didn't know yet, but what is the very ironic thing?
They're calling him,
we're going to take Malucha, right? This is really one of the big problems of the Hanukkah story, and by saying that Yehuda Amaka B, who is a Kohen, is like Yehuda, is intimating some of the problems that you are going to get to, which, according to the Ramban, is actually the primary issue here, is that Kohanim aren't allowed to take the kingdom from Yehuda. So that is... What?
That's hilarious.
Yes.
It's really
wrong. They're not allowed to do. They are Kohanim. They're allowed to take that. They are that. Right? They're not taking that away.
He embittered many kings, but he made Jacob glad by his deeds, and his memory is blessed forever. He went through the cities of Judah, and he destroyed the ungodly out of the land. Thus he turned away wrath from Israel. He was renowned to the ends of the earth, and he gathered in those who were perishing. Apollonius now gathered together the Gentiles, and a large force from Samaria came to fight against Israel. When Judah learned of this, he went out to meet him, and he defeated and killed him. Many were wounded and fell, and the rest fled. Then they seized their spoils, and Judah took the sword of Apollonius and used it in battle the rest of his life. When Saron, the commander of the Syrian army, heard that Judah had gathered a large company, including a body of faithful soldiers who stayed with him and went out to battle, he said, "I will make a name for myself and win honor in the kingdom. I will make war on Judah and his companions who scorned the king's command." Once again, a strong army of godless men went up with him to help him to take vengeance on Israel. When he approached the ascent of Beth Horon, Judah went out to meet him.
That's
stop interrupting?
Yes, why do you think it's here? Yeah.
Went out to meet him with a small company. But when they saw the army coming to meet them, they said to Judah, "How can we, few as we are, fighting against so great and so strong a multitude? And we are faint, for we have eaten nothing today." Judah replied, "It's easy for many to be hemmed in by few, for in the sight of heaven there is no difference between saving by many or by few. It's not on the size of the army that victory in battle depends, but the strength comes from heaven. They come against us in great insolence and lawlessness to destroy us, our wives, our children, and to despoil us. But we fight for our lives and our laws. He himself will crush them before us. As for you, do not be afraid of them."
Well done, well done. Very good. Okay.
That was
wonderful. Okay, good. Good. So guys, can you read the
Yes, I volunteer to read.
Good, but I want to make some points here. Okay. So now, good. But here, suddenly now, if you want to understand this story, thank you, Yosef, for reading, but if you want to understand this story, now you have to understand that this is invoking a beautiful story in Tanakh, and if you understand the story it's invoking, you will understand what's about to happen here. What story is he invoking?
Gideon.
No, not Gideon.
Yoshua.
No, not Yoshua. It's not that story, so stop asking. Yes, it's what? Gideon is the one with the... With the
And then, no, but like, he wants to stop and drink the water, and then, like, certain people in the way based on how they drink the water.
Oh, wait. Which story is he invoking?
Shaul
and...
I'm
out of it. No. Yes, with the Plishtim, because what did Shaul...
Because he said no one will eat him.
He said no one will eat, and who ends up being the hero of that story?
Me.
Yes, Yonatan, who accidentally eats because he doesn't know about it. And what happens in that story? That story that the drama is all about not eating on that day. What is the drama of that story?
Not eating doesn't
have to do Shaul gets, in conflict with everyone else, and he's alarming, and they're like... Don't kill him.
No. I mean, later. So here's that story, okay? So, second, this is Shmuel Aleph.
We in Fellowship of the
Ring. What? So this is the story in which that happens. This is Perek Yudalad in Shmuel Aleph. They're fighting the Plishtim. Vahi ayom, vayomer Yonatan ben Shaul ohanar nosei chilav, lichav na'abral matzav Plishtim asher me'ever halaz laviv lo higid. He tells his servant, just Yonatan's servant, "We're going to go fight the Plishtim. Don't tell anybody. Don't tell his father. Two people." V'shaul yoshe b'kzei agivah, tachar rimon asher b'migron, v'am asher imo kishesh me'od ish. And Shaul is with 600 people. The Achiyav and Achituv, Achi Kavod, Ben Bichas, Ben Eli, etc. So skip down to Pasuk Vav if you have a Tanakh. Vayomer Yonatan al Anar, Nosei Chilav, Lichav na Abraham Matzav Ha'arilim Ha'ila. Ulai Yaseh Adonai Lanu, Ki Ein Ladonai Matzor Lo Shia Birav Ubimat. Yonatan says, "Let's go and fight, just you and me. Let's cross over and fight these uncircumcised fellows," right? As JPS very nicely translates it, right? Ha'arelim, the uncircumcised fellows. I don't think that's strong enough, but
there's a whole new meaning to the fellows who bend things.
God. Oh God. Vayomer lo nosei chilav, asei kol asher bavavcha netelach inini imcha kelavecha. I'll go with you, but what is the theme of this story that, as we'll see, is all about this not eating on the day of battle? Right? What does Yonatan say it's all about?
Oh, it's about God saving us, not numbers.
Very good. Very good. It's about, it doesn't matter how many people you have, it's about God. Now, what images, that should, in, that
it's
should,
the theme
there are two
of
things.
Jewish history.
Well, it's a theme
come on,
of, well, we're going to see that there's a phrase that's going to come up here, which is Vayosha Hashem Bayomahu. So, what image should that bring to mind? Which means the battle against Mitzrayim. Because what's the theme of that? Hashem Yilachem Lachem. You be silent, God is fighting for you.
Right?
But specifically also Hashem fights, and you don't have to. Meaning it's really God's battle. And which is the... what one other story should this remind you of? Not the language, but the theme, which we did an hour and a bit ago. Chagai's promise that God would shake the world. Right? That it would be God who shakes it. So here's what happens. Vayomer Yonatan... Hine anachnu ovrim al anashim v'niglinu eleihem. Let us go and see them. Imko yomru eleinu dimu adigenu aleichem. V'amanu tachtinu v'lona al aleihem. If they say, wait until we get to you, then we'll stay where we are and not go up to them. V'imko yomru alu aleinu v'alinu k'nadam anayim v'neinu v'zeh lanu'od. But if they say, come up to us, we will go because God is giving them to our hands. This will be our sign. V'igalu shneihem omatzav plishtim v'yomru plishtim hine... Ivrim Yotzim and Acharem Asheret Chabusham. They said, hey, look, there's some Jews hiding. There's some Jews hiding in the holes over there. Vayanu Anshe Amatzavat Yonatan Venosechela Vayomru Alu Eleinu Venodiachem Davar. They say, come to us. Vayomru Yonatan Venosechela Alei Acharai Ki Netanam Anan Biyad Yisrael. Come with me, because God has given them to our hands.
Sounds like an ambush.
Vayal Yonatan al Yadav al Raglav v'nosei chilav acharav v'iplu lifnei Yonatan v'nosei chilav mimotet acharav. So he goes with his arms bearer, and right, and the plishtim fell, and the arms bearer would finish them off. V'tiyamaka harishonah sheikah Yonatan v'nosei chilav ki'esrim ish chatzima natzem et tzadeh. The first thing they do is kill 20 men. Vati charadav amachane basadev v'chol ama matzav amashchid chardu gam hema vatirgaz ha'arz vati lecherdat Elohim. And terror breaks out amongst the plishtim. Vayiru atzofim l'shaul b'givad binyamin v'nei amon namog v'yelech v'halom. And everyone sees this in Shaul, and they say they're scattering. And Shaul says, well, who's fighting them? Do a quick census. Who's missing? Vayomru Shaul lama sheitopik duna ruumi alach meimano veifkedu v'hine ein Yonatan v'nasei cheilav. They say we're only missing two people. Yonatan and his arms bearer. Vayomru Shaul lachia gisha rona Elohim ki haya rona Elohim v'yom ahu v'nei Yisrael v'yim diber Shaul al kohen v'man shaman al chaneb plishtim v'yel chalof v'rav v'yom Shaul al kohen esof yodecha. And he goes and he gets the aron. He asks of the aron, etc. And... right, long story short, Vayosha Adonai Bayom Hahu et Yisrael Melmechama Avrad Bad Aven. Right, the message of that whole story is Vayosha Hashem Bayom Hahu, which draws into, which the image is clearly that this is another Mitzrayim moment. Because what is similar about these themes? These are nations who think they're better than God. And the way you win is not by numbers, but by recognizing that victory comes from God. And the, but then what happens in the story? And then, and this is how you know that this story is invoking that story. Besides for the themes, which is the Ish Yisrael Nigach Shvayamahu Vayol Shaul Aram Leimor Arura Ish Yisrael Yochal Lechem Ara Erev V'Nikamti Me'evai V'Lo Teim Kol Am Lechem. But the problem was that on that day Shaul had made them promise that no one would eat. And anyone who would be cursed would be put to death. And then the drama unfolds that they find out that Yonatan not only eats, but he encourages. But he doesn't know about the vow, so he ends up eating from honey. And Shaul wants to kill him to be consistent. And the people say no. The victory came through Yonatan, and they spare his life, etc. Ray Foreman notes here that clearly this story is being invoked because what is Tanakh doing? Right, Tanakh is saying that what influences you, right, Yehuda Maccabi, is that he knows. Right, that this has happened before. This is right. The story of Yonatan and Shaul against the Plishtim invokes in explicit language, Vayosha Hashem Bayomahu, invokes Kriyat Yamzuf, which is in the language of davening on Hanukkah, Rabim Biad Me'atim. Right. The key is to recognize that victory comes from God, not from numbers. And that story invokes Mitzrayim, and this story invokes Shaul. By saying that the key was that this is a day of battle where no one was eating. right? That no one had tasted food the entire day, which is the way the pasuk describes the situation in the time of Shaul. So what are you going to expect that's going to happen in this, right? Right, if this person, the author of the Book of Maccabees, is a Tanakh influence, what do you expect to happen?
No one's going to eat.
And what's about to happen? This is the this is the setup.
The few will win.
Yes, the few are going to win. That's what you expect. This is the message. And that's what happens. When he finished speaking, he rushed suddenly against Sarah and his army. And they were, well, okay, sure, go ahead.
Go for it a little bit.
I'll go.
Yeah. When he finished speaking, he was suddenly against Saron. His army, they were crushed before him. They pursued them down the descent of Bethoron to the plain. 800 of them fell, and the rest fled into the land of the Philistines. Then Judah and his brothers began to be feared, and the terror fell in the Gentiles.
By the way, this is the key, right? How do they get victory? What's the victory? No, what's the victory?
They rushed.
The fear. Right? It's the fear. It's that initial battle. That's not sufficient. What it is that instills the fear that God, right, encourages that the killing the 20 men in the story of Yonatan is enough to change the tide of the battle, because once you have the fear, and by the way, this is how the Pesukim describe what? The way that God is going to make the battles happen in Eretz Israel. It's about fear. Right? Rahav talks about this. Right, the reason she knows he's going to win is because people fear the Jews. Right, their fear is God's tool to help Rabin Biad Me'atim. And yes, this also happens in the Gedom story, even though this, right, it's thematically similar, even if linguistically it doesn't have the same. Okay, go.
And terror fell Gentiles all around them. His fame reached the king, and the Gentiles talked of the battles of Judah. When King Antiochus heard these reports, he was greatly angered, and he sent and gathered all the forces of his kingdom, a very strong army. He opened his coffers and gave a year's pay to his forces and ordered them to be ready for any need. Then he saw the money in the treasury was exhausted, and the revenues from the country were small because of the dissension and disaster that he had caused in the land by abolishing the laws that had existed from the earliest days. He feared that he might not have such funds as he had before, for his expenses and for his gifts, they used to give more lavishly than preceding kings. He was greatly perplexed in mind, and then he determined to go to Persia and collect the revenues from those regions and raise a large fund. He left Lysias, a distinguished man of royal lineage, in charge of the king's affairs. From the River Euphrates to the borders of Egypt, Lysias was also to take care of his son Antiochus until he returned and turned over to Lysias half of his forces and the elephants, and gave him orders about all that he wanted done.
Okay, so we're going to have to do a little bit of skipping. We'll do a little bit of skipping here, right? We've read a good chunk now of it. Now, they're obviously going to describe some of this. You've read excellently, Yosef, but we're going to do a little bit of skipping. So let's, if you go to the other... If we want, we'll bring back Yosef for an encore. We'll bring him an encore. So if you go to the second column here, to the paragraph, right, now Judah and his brothers saw that misfortunes had increased and the forces were encamped in their territory. They also learned what the king commanded to the people and to cause their final destruction. They said to one another, "Let us restore the ruins of our people and fight for our people in the temple." So the congregation assembled to be ready for battle and to pray and ask for mercy and compassion. Jerusalem was uninhabited like a wilderness, right? This is the psukim we already read in Echa, right? These are already psukim in Echa. Not one of her sons went in or out. The temple was trampled down, and Eliot had held the citadel. Again, these are all quotes from Echa, because obviously this is a korban, right? This is a korban. It was a lodging place for the Gentiles. Joy was taken from Jacob. The flute and the harp ceased to play. They gathered together and went to Mitzpah opposite Jerusalem, because Israel formerly had a place of prayer in Mitzpah. They fasted, they put on sackcloth, sprinkled ashes on their heads, and tore their clothes, which is like, you know, a combination of like Yonah, a successful version of Yonah in Nineveh, and Esther stories of the Jews doing tshuva. But these are like classic tropes in Tanakh. They opened the scroll of the law to inquire into those matters about what the Gentiles consult the likeness of their gods, where they are Doresh et Hashem. They brought the vestments of the priesthood and the first fruits and the tithes. They stirred up the Nazarites who completed their days, and they cried aloud to heaven, saying, "What shall we do with these? Where shall we take them? Your temple is trampled down and profaned. Your priests mourn humiliation, and here are the Gentiles who assembled against us to destroy us. You know that they plot against us." This is all Tanakh quotes. "How will we be able to withstand them if you do not help us?" And they sounded the trumpets and gave a loud shout. And after this, Judah appointed leaders of the people in charge of thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens. This is obviously a Moshe moment. Those who are building houses or about to be married or about to planting a vineyard or faint-hearted are told to go home according to the law. If you want evidence that they're keeping the Torah, here you go. They send home all the people who... Right, this is a pasuk in Chumash. He tells you where, if you don't know. This is Devarim Perek Chaf. Right, anyone who had just gotten married or was planting a vineyard, right, or were scared, they went home. That is the law of war. Right, this they keep halacha here. Remember, right, they keep halacha. Then the army marched out and encamped to the south of Emmaus, and Judah said, "Arm yourselves and be courageous. Be ready in the morning to fight against these Gentiles who have assembled against us to destroy us and our temple. It is better for us to die in battle than to see misfortunes of our nation and of the temple. But as his will in heaven may be, so shall he do." That's very Hanani Mishael Ba'Azariah. Look, I'd rather die right than violate the Torah. If I have to die, then kachazeb. And then in chapter 4, so Gorgias gets the battle, right? They're running. Second paragraph. At daybreak, Judah appeared in the plain with 3,000 men. But they did not have armor and swords such as they desired, and they saw the camp of the Gentiles strong and fortified with cavalry all around it. And these men were trained in war. But Judah said to them, "Do not fear their numbers or be afraid when they charge. Remember, our fathers were saved in the Red Sea and Pharaoh." Right? If you didn't believe me when I said there were Pesach references before, then believe Yehuda Maccabi, who says that explicitly, which says, "Don't be afraid. Remember, Kriyat Yamsuf, people." Right? If you haven't yet been convinced that this is a intertextual book about Tanakh, then just believe Yehuda when he says that. He says that his forces pursue them, and now let us cry to heaven and see whether he will favor us and remember his covenant with our fathers and crush this army before us, that all the Gentiles will know that there is one who redeems and saves Israel. When the foreigners looked up and saw them coming against them, and they went out from their camp to battle, then the men with Judah blew their trumpets and engaged in battle. The Gentiles were crushed and fled into the plain, and all those in the rear fell by the sword. Here, you can take over, because I know people are dying for the encore. Yosef, say go.
They pursued them to Gazra, and to the plains of Idumea, and to Azotus, and Jamia, and 3,000 of them fell. Then Judah's forces turned back from pursuing them, and he said to the people, "Do not be greedy for plunder, for there is a battle before us. Gorgias and his forces are near us in the hills, but stand now against our enemies and fight them. And afterwards, seize the plunder boldly." Just as Judah was finishing this speech, the detachment appeared coming from the hills. They saw their army had been put to flight, and that the Jews were burning the camp for the smoke that was seen show what had happened. When they perceived this, they were greatly frightened. And when they also saw the army of Judah drawn up in the plain for battle, they all fled into the land of the Philistines. The Jew returned to plunder the camp and seized a great amount of gold and silver, cloth dyed blue, and sea purple in great riches.
Right, cloth dyed blue is what in Hebrew is. Okay, thank you. Notice that.
On their return, they sang palsums, psalms, and praises to heaven. "He is good in his fate, and his faithful forgiving, loving kindness endures forever."
Tov Hashem, like, oh, right, etc. Right, Kasto, Lidor Hador, things like that. What do you notice, by the way, of this unit? You should notice something very important about what we just read. Come on.
Which part?
What is the key to Hanukkah? And we know this, right? What is the key to Hanukkah? Come on.
What
is the mitzvah of Hanukkah?
Oh, candles. Fire.
No!
Oh, that's the whole point.
No!
Shemini-nisa.
What?
Organizing your
scroll. Saying Hallel.
Saying Hallel. Thank you. That's what it says. These are Yamim of Shirov and Tishbachot. That's what the Gemara says. Right? Have you read it? Someone now, open the Rambam and read it to me. Thank you. You should notice this. This is, remember, what miracle never appears here? Spoiler alert.
The menorah
miracle, right? That does not appear in Maccabees. No, it never appears anywhere. It only appears in Chazal.
Yikes.
And we'll maybe discuss that in a minute. But what you see here, but the central miracle, just like we have in Al-Anisim, is Rabim Biad Me'atim, and the central mitzvah of Hanukkah is therefore Shira about that. So please read it.
You don't want to read it? I don't know. It's in there somewhere.
Really?
I don't know which parrot.
So the thing the Rambam talks about.
It's either Gimel or Dalet.
The book that has all the Rambam. It's either
something. Vivayi Cheni. This is the Rambam's historical description of what we have just read. B'vayit sheni kishamalchu Yavan gazu gzeirot al Yisrael. Right? During the Second Temple, when Yavan, when Greece was king, they made decrees against the Jewish people. B'tlu datam, they nullified the religion. B'lonicho damasok b'torah mitzvot. They didn't let them keep the mitzvot or learn Torah. Pashtir yadamo namu v'notiham. They took their money and their daughters. Right? You should now all realize that this is all exactly what happened. Nechasu leichal farsu b'rtso. They went into the Beit HaMikdash. They made breaches, timu atarot, they made the pure things impure. Mitzar lem Yisrael ma'od mipneihem, v'lachatzum lachatz gadol, they caused great oppression, ad sherichem aleihem Elohei avoteinu, until the God of our forefathers had mercy on them, v'oshiyam miyadam, and saved them. V'gavru b'nei chashmonai ha-kohanim ha-gadolim v'haragum, and chashmonayim, the children of the Kohanim, right, the Kohanim gadolim, rose up and fought them, v'oshiyu Yisrael miyadam, and save the Jewish people. Ve'emidu melech men ha-kohanim v'chazra malchut l'Yisrael yet al matayim shana ad ha-korban ha-sheni. And malchut returned back to them. Shegavru Yisrael oivehem v'ibdum. And then after that, once they destroy the enemies, the next thing they do, then he brings the right, chazals. Nespach ha-shemen b'chamisha v'esrim. They only found one pure thing of oil. Because of this, they commanded that the eight days starting the 25th of Kislev. How does he define it? What is the Rambam's halachic description of Hanukkah? What are the next words? Yemei Simcha V'Halel. Days of joy and praise to God. That is the definition of Hanukkah. Right, so even in the right, even post-Chazal, where we're talking about Nesbach HaShemen, according to the Rambam, the definition of the Chag is not
the lights.
It is Halel. It is Halel. If you want evidence of this, remember, on Pesach, we only say Halel on how many days?
Two.
First day.
One.
Eight.
Please don't tell me what happens in Chutz Laretz.
Oh, yeah.
On one day, yes, we say half Halel on the rest of the days, but as, remember, half Halel is not Halel.
Yes.
It is fake Halel. That's really what it is. Right? It is fake Halel. Right? It is not of the 18 days that you say Halel or 21 days in Chutz Laretz. You only say it on the first day. On Hanukkah, how many days you say Halel? Eight. Echitachein. How could it be that on Pesach you say it on one day and on Hanukkah you say it on eight? And the reason is because on Hanukkah that is literally the definition. There is no Isra Malacha. There is no anything. Right? There is no. The only thing that makes the day special is Din Yimei Halel V'Simcha. That's the definition, right? The performance you do is you light the candles, but the definition of the day is Yimei Simcha. Right? This is what several Achronim note. Rizalti has a piece like this, right? That when it comes to Yimei Simcha V'Halel, Hanukkah, there is a Maisa Mitzvah. But as much as we identify Hanukkah with the lighting of the candles, no! The definition halachically of the day, it's a halos of Yimei Halel V'Simcha. That's why you say Halel on 8 days, even though there's no Isra Malacha, and on Pesach you only say it on one. How could it be more than Pesach? This is why. But you see that this is actually, right, when you read the book, this is what it was.
Well, on Sukkot you say it on every day, right?
Yeah, that's another thing. Right, the other interesting thing is that it parallels Sukkot. Now, we actually won't see that, because if I remember correctly, that's in Maccabees 2, is the connection to Sukkot. But you see this, right, and that this is the... this is the miracle. And by the way, if you just skip down to the indented point, if you didn't believe me that this is invoking the story of Yonatan and Shaul, and the notion that Rabbi Biad Me'atim is a theme throughout Tanakh, and that he's invoking on it, look at his speech from the next year. Blessed are you, O Savior of Israel, who crushed the attack of the mighty warrior by the hand of your servant David, and gave the camp of the Philistines into the hands of Jonathan, son of Saul, and of the men who carried the armor. Right? If you didn't believe me that this is meant to invoke that and tell you that this is a theme throughout Tanakh, and that if you want to understand the mindset of the Chashmonaim, you have to realize that they see themselves living in a theological continuity with Tanakh, then just read the speeches. Right? And this is why, when you read Maccabees, you really... again, this is why I'm convinced when I read Maccabees that the reason it's not part of Tanakh is because it's too late. There's nothing in here that is, this is, if anything, much more, maybe it's too explicit, right? In Tanakh, it's never quite this in your face, I am being intertextual, right? In Maccabees, he's like, look, I'm being intertextual, right? Did you not catch my references before? Look, pay attention. Yes, hem in his army by the hand of your people, Israel, and let them be ashamed of their troops and their cavalry, fill them with cowardice. Melt the boldness of their strength, let them tremble in their destruction, strike them down with the sword of those who love you, and let all who know your name praise you with psalms. If you haven't figured out that A, this is Tanakh, and B, that the mitzvah hayom is Hallel, then you have not been paying attention to this book. That is how this works. This is what he is doing. And then you skip down after the next battle. What happens? Judah and his brothers said, see, our enemies are crushed. Let us go up to cleanse the temple and dedicate it.
Wait, what was the year of the last year?
What? Battles. There's these battles go on. It's not a one-time battle. This goes on for years. So all the army assembled, went up to Mount Zion, where they saw the temple desolate, the altar profaned, and the gates burned. In the court, they saw bushes sprung up, as in a thicket or as on one of the mountains. They saw also the chambers of the priests in ruins, and they tore their clothes and mourned with great lamentation. They sprinkled themselves with ashes and fell down on the ground, and when the signal was given with the trumpets, they cried out to heavens. Then Judah detailed men to fight against those in the citadel, and he cleansed the temple. He chose blameless priests devoted to the law, and they cleansed the temple and removed the defiled stones to an unclean place. They deliberated what to do with the altar of burnt sacrifice, which had been profaned. They thought it best to tear it down so that it would not be a lasting shame to them, and the Gentiles had defiled it. So they tore down the altar and stored the stones in a convenient place in the Temple Mount until a prophet should come to tell them what to do. They then took unhewn stones, as the law directs them, and built a new altar like the former one. They also rebuilt the temple and the interior of the temple and consecrated the courts. They made new holy vessels and brought the lampstead, the altar of incense, and the table into the temple. And they offered incense on the altar of incense and lit the lamps on the lampstead and gave light to that. These gave light in the temple. They placed the bread on the table and hung up the curtains when they'd finished all the work and they had undertaken. Early in the morning, the 25th day of the ninth month, which is the month of Kislev, in 148th year, they rose and offered sacrifices, the law directs, on the new altar of burnt sacrifice that they had built. And on that very season, on the very day the Gentiles had profaned it, it was dedicated with songs and harps and lutes and cymbals, and all the people fell on their faces and worshipped and blessed the God of heaven who had prospered them. They celebrated the dedication of the altar for 8 days and joyfully offered burnt sacrifices. They offered a sacrifice of oneness with God and a thanksgiving sacrifice. They decorated the front of the temple with gold crowns and small shields. They restored the gates and the chambers for the priests and fitted them with doors. There was great joy amongst the people, and the disgrace brought by the Gentiles was removed. Then Judah and his brothers and all the assembly of Israel determined that every year at that season, the days of dedication of the altar should be observed with joy and gladness for 8 days, beginning with the 25th day of the month of Kislev. Right, and that is the story of Hanukkah. After this, you get even more battles and so on, but I think we'll stop here and you can read it yourself. Let me make a few points, though, okay? The comparison to Hanukkah to Sukkot, again, if I remember, unless I'm missing it and it's later, I'm pretty sure it's in the parallel version in Maccabees 2. The few points that you should have gotten from here, right, besides forgetting the story, is, again, this is clearly a theological continuity of Tanakh, a belief that the fundamental miracle, the fundamental message of Hanukkah was Rabim Biyad Me'atim, and the expression of that is Shira, right? It's Halal v'Shira, exactly as the Rambam describes it, that it's about the rededication of the Mikdash, which is, again, made more explicit in Maccabees 2, is exactly what Haggai said would happen, right? This is continuity for them with Pinchas, hence the zealotry, with Moshe, the zealotry of Moshe, hence all the indications of Moshe, right? Mila Shemelai and fleeing to the desert because they killed someone and making the king angry, and the explicit references to Pinchas because of killing people to save the Jewish people, and the explicit references to Yonatan and Shaul about Rabbi Biyad Me'atim, and that story itself being in dialogue with Vayosha Hashem Bayomahu and being Mitzrayim, which again he invokes here. But this is a theological continuity. The miracles Rabbi Biyad Me'atim, and part of it is that they then were able to rededicate the Mikdash because that's the fulfillment of Haggai. Right? That's the miracle. That's why they're celebrating. That's why they're celebrating for 8 days. That's why they're celebrating with Shira. Okay? And I hope that now that you've actually read this is where, you know, until now we get Hanukkah. After it is what happens after Hanukkah, right? Because the battles continue. This is the middle. You should know this is only the middle. That's maybe one point you haven't realized enough, but the fact that there's still more than half the book to go should remind you that Hanukkah is only the first round. The battles continue for quite a while. Most of the Maccabim don't survive till the end. I think only Yehuda survives by the end of this, by the end of this book.
Why is the middle?
No, Yehuda dies.
What?
Yehuda dies. He's the first one.
I mean, it's there. But the last thing we have to talk about is the fact that what should be glaring at you, though, is that the missing thing in the Book of Maccabees, we now have a greater understanding of a lot of things in Hanukkah, but the one thing that we are now left with the question every time you read the Book of Maccabees is, what happened to Nes Pach HaShemen? So, you will get different Sarah. The academic view will be, well, guess what? This is evidence that it didn't happen, right? That this is the evidence that it didn't happen.
No.
The alternative is to say, the alternative is to say that it did happen, but there are different versions of this. There are different versions of this. Guys, there are different versions of this, but essentially, the firmer version of people who've actually read the Book of Maccabees and think that it's not total garbage and then have to deal with Chazal is to say something along the lines of the following. It did happen, but its significance emerged later. Why? Because in the time of Hanukkah, the central miracle was clearly the victory, as it's described here. And to be fair, our tefillot still record that. Right? In the tefillot, the nace that we focus on is not at all the miracle of the Pach HaShemen. It's just not. It's Rabim Mir Miatim and Chanukah Rabayit. Right? If you read Maccabees and the only thing you knew about Hanukkah was Al HaNisim, it would be complete consonance. Right? It's not like the Tefillah there doesn't talk about Nes Pach HaShemen at all. And in the time of Hanukkah, that was the central miracle. What's the problem? That miracle is worth celebrating if
you lived through.
No, if you're not in the time of Churban. Because remember what the Gemara says? That all the celebrations in Megillat Ta'anit that recorded victories, they were all batel with Churban Abayit. Why? Because victories aren't meaningful once you're back in Galut and the remnant of the victory has completely been erased. But if you want to continue celebrating, what does Chazal say? There are two Chagim that we still celebrate despite the fact Megillat Ta'anit is gone. What are they? Hanukkah and Purim. Why? Because they have a lasting message. They have a second component to them and not just the victory. So the firmer approach to this, so to speak, is to say something along the lines of, yes, it happened. But in the time of Hanukkah, even if it happened, that wasn't the reason they celebrated. The reason they celebrated was it was a victory. It was time of Halloween cheer. It was Rabim Biad Me'atim. But once there was a Churban, why was this the one that had staying power? Because there was the Nes Pach HaShemen. And why was that important? So again, there are different versions of this, but I'll give you one. They're different, right? One, for guys who are in my shir, know that one of them is that Chazal described that there's a 8-day light festival since the time of Adam Arishon, which became a pagan festival, Saturnalia, Saturnia, in the dead of winter, which means that part of this story is that there was a light festival, right? There was always a light festival. Chazal understood this as something going back to Adam Arishon around this time of year, so picking up on that with the Nes Pach HaShemen and the celebration of light is actually a throwback to the Chag of Adam Arishon.
Wouldn't that be Avodah Zarah?
No, it preceded Avodah Zarah. The Avodah Zarah took it, but in Chazal's understanding, this goes back to Adam Arishon, right? That Adam, when he saw the world waning, right, he saw darkness, he thought the world was coming to an end because of his sin, and when he saw at the deep of winter, right, this week, right, this week, either last week or this week is the shortest, right, is the earliest Shabbos, and then it starts getting later again, right? You see the dead of winter, that light starts to come a little bit more. There was a celebration of light. This is the oldest tradition in the world, according to Chazal. Right? So that might be part of the answer, is that Chazal pick up on it because it fits with this ancient celebration. The other possibility, again, these are all not mutually exclusive. If we had more time, maybe I'd give a whole share just on that, but you can check it out. We did it last year when we were doing Avodah Zarah. Part of it is also that what seems to be the message, there are also, by the way, hints in Chumash of the existence of this Chag, in Baal Otcha, there are Rimazim, many Rimazim, and again, that's a share for another time. But part of it is that the fundamental miracle of the Mizbach HaShemen is that God is there, right? There's no nevuah, right? That's clearly missing from this book. So how do they know that God is there?
A nace,
a small nace that just says God is there, despite the fact it doesn't look like that, but it's a confirmation that the rest is a nace. But the way it might have been is that was just a confirmation that all this really was the spiritual holiday that they thought it was, that this is God making Rabim Biad Me'atim. And by God making a small little miracle, that is an indication, a world without nevuah, that God is there. But after the Churban, the victory doesn't mean anything. But the message that God is there, even when things are hard, and even when it's dark, and even when you're in Galut, and even when you're being oppressed by your enemies, God is there, right? That message is critical. And therefore, the firmer approach is to say, maybe it happened, but fundamentally, in the time of Hanukkah itself, its role was to confirm the theological overtones, or undertones, or whatever, of the miracle, of the miraculous victories, to say, this is God. So they wouldn't say, Kochi v'otzem yadi, and the like, but once you had the Churban, the victory, we know that right, miracles that were commemorated in holidays about victories disappeared.
Yes.
But in order for Hanukkah to maintain its message, the other miracle, which Chazal had a tradition, which apparently is not in Book of Maccabees, that becomes the central one. So again, there are different versions of that vort, but fundamentally I think that would be right the way of explaining that, is that if you assume that this happened, so why is it not played up in the Book of Maccabees? Because maybe in the time of Maccabees that wasn't the central miracle. It may have happened, but it was still not the central miracle, because at best it was just an indication of the miracle of Rabim Biad Me'atim being God. The irony, and this, I'll end with this, is that Hanukkah, for all that's clearly the message, Rabim Biad Me'atim and God and the like, the irony is that in modern Israel it became, for a long time, the symbol of secularism. It was the flip, which was epitomized by what? What song? No. No. Mi Yimalel. So no, but the Hanukkah song made up by the secular Zionist was Mi Yimalel Gvurot Yisrael. They took a pasuk in Daylan, which is Mi Yimalel Gvurot Hashem. And they flipped it on purpose. And you know what they held on Hanukkah, the early secular Zionists? What do you think they held on Hanukkah? Olympics! Right, Olympics, it was a total flip. Right? The irony was they recognized, on the one hand, they identified with part of the Hasmonim, but not the religious overtones. So they mamish flipped it on its head and said, no, the message of Hanukkah is that we can be great. And that was why people got so angry, because of all holidays, Hanukkah's message is that even secular battles are fundamentally victories of Hashem. And if you guys are interested in that, I can send you Makaro just on this. I once gave a shiur called The Secular Zionist Hanukkah on this point, on how it was totally, totally and completely twisted. Because when you read the Book of Maccabees, you realize that is the message of Hanukkah, is that victories, which seem secular, are fundamentally religious. Okay, we have gone for like 2.5 hours, so let's call it a night, guys. What? No, we also did the Chagai. From the beginning?